The audio portion of this webinar will be posted on our website. There will be a question and answer portion at the end of this presentation. Please notice the control panel on your screen. In the text box, please type in any questions you may have, and they will be answered in the order they were received at the end of this presentation. Here is our Executive Director, Stephen Smith, to introduce today's finalist.
Well, good afternoon. Courtney, can I hear me okay?
I can hear you great.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us. This is the third of our webinar finalists in the Golf Challenge. As I've outlined with each of the presentations, SACE is a nonprofit organization that does work throughout the Southeast, primarily in five southern states, Florida, the Carolinas, Georgia, and Tennessee. And we have historically focused on energy policy, trying to reduce the environmental footprint of how we produce and consume energy in the utility sector around electricity production. But over the last 24 months or so, have been shifting more and more into the transportation sector along with our work on utilities. And we have been looking at issues around climate policy, global warming, energy efficiency, clean energy, which is around renewable electricity, clean fuels, which is around alternative renewable fuels for the transportation sector, and also an area where we talk about what we call high-risk energy choices. And it's in the context of the high-risk energy choices that includes coal-fired power plants, nuclear power plants, and also offshore drilling. And we began looking at offshore drilling fairly intensely back when, during the 2008 election, when it became very clear that there was a lot of momentum building for opening up offshore drilling off the outer continental shelf, some of our southern states, the Carolinas, Georgia, and then also off the Gulf of Mexico, where Florida had largely prevented that. And we began looking at that in more detail, but we're still sort of on the learning curve. And then we were very unhappy when the president announced back in March that he was indeed going to change U.S. policy and have a more forward, favorable position on offshore drilling. Sadly, within 3 weeks or so after he made that announcement, the tragedy that is unfolding in the Gulf with the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig off in the Gulf of Mexico began to unfold. And as Courtney said, we're in the 78th, 79th day of the disaster, and it has been absolutely devastating to the coast. I have both flown over the rig and have been down and seen the oil sort of firsthand in the water and on the beaches of some of the states, and I'm just very saddened by that. So it quickly after that happened, we began to think, how can we reframe this discussion? It was evident to us that the rationale for the risky endeavor of offshore drilling and really going more aggressively into that area was motivated primarily by this false dichotomy between either you're going to have to import oil from a number of hostile nations that really don't have the long-term best interest of the United States in mind, many of those centered around the Persian Gulf region of the Middle East, or we're going to have to increase domestic production, and most of our domestic production is really going to be in offshore drilling, and because there's really not that much oil out there, we're going to go further into deep water drilling and ultra deep water drilling, basically getting to the outer limits of what is technologically feasible and also what can be done safely. And the sad irony is that the Deepwater Horizon accident or devastation that's being unleashed right now is a clear indication that the oil companies are in literally over their head in what they can technologically do, and the fact that they've been unable to stop the massive flow of oil into the Gulf leading to the devastation is just a very sad commentary on where we are. But we wanted to put the best and the brightest, put a challenge out to the best and brightest and say, look, what would it take? I mean, what does it really amount to, the amount of oil that we get from the Middle East and the amount we get from the Gulf of Mexico? And we've been hearing, we had a number of entrants, and we've been hearing over the last couple of days from several of those, and we're very excited today to have Simon present his work with Oceana on looking at how you can actually develop that path for this nation, again, not only to end our addiction to oil from foreign hostile nations, but also get out of offshore drilling altogether. So with that said, let me turn it over to Simon and look forward to hearing his work.
Thanks, Steve. Courtney, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Excellent. Well, good afternoon. My name is Simon Mahan. I am the campaign analyst for Oceana's climate change campaign. Oceana is an international ocean conservation organization dedicated to protecting, preserving, and restoring the world's oceans. We have approximately 300,000 members worldwide and offices around the globe. Oceana works to win concrete policy objectives to protect our oceans. Since our inception in 2001, Oceana has won numerous victories, including having some 6,400 grocery stores post warning signs about mercury in seafood, eliminating mercury pollution from several major mercury emitters, protecting more than 1 million acres of ocean from destructive bottom trawling practices, and placing a ban on illegal drift net techniques in the Mediterranean. Our techniques and tactics get real, measurable results for our oceans. Next slide, please. Part of my job as analyst is to evaluate offshore energy production, including oil, natural gas, and wind energy. At Oceana, we've been focused on eliminating offshore oil drilling and promoting offshore wind energy. We are grateful that the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy has invited us to present our vision on how we achieve that goal. So without delay, let's get started. Next slide. Today, I'm going to outline Oceana's vision. In order to do that, we need to create a roadmap of where we are going without a vision, why we're going there, where we want to go with our vision, how to get there, and what happens once we achieve our vision. But before we do this, we need to understand why this vision is so important and why we need a clean energy future. Next. Where there is no vision, the people perish, says Proverbs chapter 29, verse 18. For far too long, the United States has lacked a true vision to modernize to a clean energy economy. Certainly, there are many ways to cut oil consumption. Some are better than others. Oceana Vision 2020 is one possible way to drastically cut oil use. Our vision aims to eliminate the need for offshore oil drilling and oil imports from the Persian Gulf by cutting oil consumption in residential and commercial heating, power plant generation, shipping, and light-duty vehicles, and offsetting oil with advanced biofuels and offshore wind energy. Using public and private partnerships like loan guarantees, tax credits, research and development, and a host of other initiatives, Oceana's ultimate vision of eliminating offshore oil drilling and all oil imports would save the American consumer some $374 billion by 2035. With this vision, some 74% of oil consumption will be curtailed. Consumers will save money, more jobs will be created, and the worst effects of climate change and ocean acidification can be averted. But for now, our country lacks vision. We've relied too heavily on fossil fuels, particularly oil. This lack of vision is not without consequence. Next slide. Burning fossil fuels for energy produces massive amounts of pollutants, including carbon dioxide, a potent greenhouse gas that not only causes climate change, but makes our oceans more acidic. Ocean acidification is climate change's evil twin. Even if we prevent the planet from becoming too warm, but do not significantly cut carbon dioxide, ocean acidification will slowly dissolve and threaten shell-based animals that much of the oceans and we depend on. Without vision, we resign our future to one of climate instability, insecure energy supplies, and dangerous Faustian bargains. Next slide. So where are we going without a vision? the Department of Energy estimates offshore oil drilling will expand significantly over the next quarter century, thanks in part to President Obama's opening up new areas of the Atlantic Ocean to offshore oil drilling. These areas had been protected from drilling for nearly 30 years under bipartisan agreements. Now, new offshore oil drilling can take place from Florida on up to Delaware. As long as we consume oil at current rates, companies will push to open every acre of our oceans to drilling. We need a vision to prevent this from happening. Next slide. Why are we headed in this dangerous direction? The largest consumption of oil products occurs in the transportation sector, specifically in light-duty vehicles. The Department of Energy estimates already assume that average cars sold in 2020 will get about 40 miles per gallon. So calling for things like raising CAFE standards to only 40 miles per gallon are already expected to be achieved by 2020 and don't actually save you a drop of oil over the DOE projected status quo. Since our vehicles are the biggest problem, it also makes it the hardest to solve. But Oceana's vision looks for the easiest, quickest ways to achieve meaningful reductions in oil consumption and tackles the biggest problems slowly over time. So what does this vision look like? Where do we want to go? Next slide. The worst thing that can happen is that our vision isn't visionary, that it doesn't take into consideration current estimates and projections and try to write the course before we get too far down the road. Oceana's vision aims to eliminate offshore oil production and Persian Gulf oil imports by 2020. In order to achieve this, we must cut crude oil consumption by 26%, or about 3.9 million barrels per day. Oceana would like to go a step further and propose we should stop all current and proposed offshore oil production and all oil imports by 2035, or about a 75% reduction in oil consumption over a quarter century. Next slide. Oceana's vision requires a host of technologies and techniques to get us to an oil-independent future. There are a whole range of tools to cut oil consumption, such as improving shipping efficiency, growing more biofuel, getting better vehicles, eliminating oil-based electricity, replacing oil-based heating, and building offshore wind farms. By using a variety of technologies and techniques, tackling different sectors of the oil economy, Oceana's vision requires only small changes over the next decade, like changing 1% of our electricity generation and modernizing 5% of our homes, and not impossible ideas like replacing all of our vehicles with hydrogen fuel cell technologies or every vehicle into electric cars, or bad ideas like replacing oil with other dirty fuels like natural gas or coal to liquids. By making these slight changes over the decade, we should save about 3.9 million barrels of oil per day in 2020, or the amount expected to come from offshore oil and Persian Gulf imports combined. One of the lowest hanging fruits, next slide. One of the lowest hanging fruits in Oceana's vision is fuel efficiency within the shipping sector of our economy. Over 90% of world trade is carried across the world's oceans by some 90,000 marine vessels. Like all modes of transportation that use fossil fuels, ships produce carbon dioxide emissions that significantly contribute to global climate change and ocean acidification. Estimates show that these vessels consume about 430,000 barrels of oil products per day in 2008. These vessels can reduce fuel consumption by 25% or more by simply slowing down and employing other operational and technological methods currently available. This is possible without major retrofits or heavy costs to the ship owners. A study by the International Maritime Organization shows the maritime vessel fleet could cut fuel consumption by as much as 75% with current technology. Next slide. Biofuels can directly replace or supplant crude oil consumption in ships, our vehicles, our homes for heating, and power plants to generate electricity. Simply mixing in additional ethanol and biodiesel to our fuel can directly supplant some 15 to 20% of our transportation-based oil consumption without radically having to alter our vehicles. Flex fuel vehicles can operate on straight gasoline or E85, which is about 15% gasoline and 85% ethanol. The production of biofuels, though, should be made a priority. but not at the expense of consumers by over-reliance on food-related feedstock like corn. Non-food-related feedstock include biomass such as algae, switchgrass, and crop residue like stalks and straw. Next slide. The potential for biofuels is vast. The Department of Energy has created the National Biofuels Action Plan to identify resource potential and policy recommendations to reach 35 billion gallons of biofuel production by 2022. The Department of Energy also, just last week, released the National Algal Biofuels Technology Roadmap and also announced $24 million in grants for public-private research in algal biofuels. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory is working to commercialize some 3.9 million barrels of cellulosic ethanol production per day that doesn't depend on food-based feedstock. A study commissioned by Sandia National Laboratories and General Motors identifies some 90 billion gallons of domestic biofuel production potential by 2030, or nearly 5.9 million barrels of production per day. By harnessing this valuable domestic renewable resource, we can power much of our energy needs without depending so heavily on oil. Next slide. Biofuels can be mixed with straight gasoline or diesel to offset a portion of their consumption. Meanwhile, other vehicles will run on electricity and eventually hydrogen to cut oil consumption. But many technologies are commercially available today and can drastically cut oil consumption. Light-duty vehicles like the hybrid electric Toyota Prius, the diesel Volkswagen Jetta TDI, the 2011 plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, the Chevy Volt, and the all-electric 2011 Nissan Leaf are available currently or are for pre-sale. Next slide. On average, some 15.7 million light-duty vehicles, LDVs, including cars, SUVs, and trucks, are sold annually in the United States. Based on Oceana's estimates, some 173 million LDVs will be sold in the U.S. over the next decade. These vehicles are estimated to consume 6.4 million barrels of oil daily in 2020. By encouraging the sale of alternative fuel vehicles like diesel, hybrid electric, plug-in hybrid electric, and fully electric vehicles, significant reductions in gasoline consumption can occur. By 2035, plug-in biodiesel hybrid electrics and hydrogen fuel cell technology should be readily available to the entire transportation sector to replace the need for gasoline-based vehicles. Electrified vehicles have the side benefit of being able to store excess electricity generated by variable renewable energy resources like wind power. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory has investigated this and has shown that wind energy can charge electrified vehicles, which can then act as a baseload source for electricity, offsetting other dirty fuels like coal and natural gas. Next slide. As electric-based vehicles are increased, it is important to prevent these cars from being charged with dirty fossil fuels, including oil. Oil-based electric generation is a tiny amount of U.S. electricity supply, about 1%. But it consumes a considerable amount of oil, approximately 210,000 barrels of oil per day. Meanwhile, clean forms of generating electricity readily exist. This represents another means to cut oil consumption. Clean energy should be used to replace oil-based electricity generation. Next slide. Some 68% of oil-based electric generation takes place in the South Atlantic, the Mid-Atlantic, New England, and Great Lakes regions. These regions have substantial offshore wind energy potential. Next slide. Just like oil-based electricity generation, oil use in heating our homes and businesses is needless and outdated. In 2005, more than 12 billion gallons of fuel oil, kerosene, and liquid petroleum gas were consumed by some 23 million homes for space and water heating. Oil-based heating is unnecessary and is often the most expensive way to heat a home. Electric-based heating is readily available, and solar water heating and geothermal ground source heat pumps do not rely on fossil fuels. Of the oil consumed for home heating purposes, Some 66% is consumed in New England, the Mid-Atlantic, and South Atlantic regions. Another 15% is consumed in the Great Lakes region. Over the next quarter century, these homes and commercial businesses should be modernized to oil-free heating, like electric, solar, or geothermal heating. Again, these regions contain substantial offshore wind energy potential. Next slide. Any plan that looks to electrify vehicles and homes and our electric generation must take into consideration the increases in electricity demand. Swapping an oil addiction for a natural gas, coal, or nuclear addiction is not clean energy policy. To highlight the importance of offshore wind energy, let's look at its potential to supplant oil consumption. Offshore wind farms have been operational in Europe for nearly 20 years. Europe plans on installing some 150 gigawatts of offshore wind energy capacity by 2030. This would power up to 16% of the entire continent and create some 300,000 jobs. The benefits of offshore wind energy are likely to outweigh the localized environmental impacts for most areas. Next slide. The majority of oil-based electric generation, as well as oil-based space and water heating, occurs on the Atlantic coast, exactly where the best offshore wind energy resources lie. By following Europe's lead, the United States could potentially build 20 gigawatts of offshore wind energy capacity by 2020 in order to replace oil-based electric generation and meet the new electricity demand from electric-based heating. Building this much offshore wind energy, based on the UK's estimate, could create some 34,000 jobs here in the United States. A side benefit of utilizing offshore wind energy is that the resource is where the demand is, on the coast. Therefore, it is unnecessary in these early stages of offshore wind development to build tens of thousands of miles of transmission lines from one place to another, which saves time, money, and effort. Next slide. All of the technologies and techniques necessary to achieve Oceania's vision to eliminate offshore oil drilling and Persian Gulf oil imports have proven track records and are readily available. For instance, a variety of international shipping companies have proven that slowing their fleets requires no retrofits, cuts fuel consumption, and can save on fuel costs. The DOE estimates that nearly 349 million barrels of liquid fuel supply will come in renewable forms like ethanol and biodiesel this year. Light-duty vehicles already exist that radically cut oil consumption, including hybrid electric vehicles. Nearly 99% of our electricity comes from other sources than petroleum-based fuels, showing the non-essential nature of oil-based electric generation. Conversion from fuel oil-based home heating to electric heating is technologically possible. Offshore wind farms have been operational in Europe for the past 20 years without major harm to the marine life. By doing all this, Oceania Vision will cut oil consumption by about 3.9 million barrels of oil per day in 2020. With the numerous public and private investment strategies available, Oceania believes the needed quantity of these technologies will be achievable. Next slide. One public-private partnership we've identified is the link between utility companies and universities. For example, let's look at Delaware. The University of Delaware has created a vehicle-to-grid program whereby connections are added to cars so that electricity stored in the electric cars can be returned to the grid. Delaware has also passed a law requiring electric utility companies to compensate electric vehicle owners at the same rate that they pay to charge their car batteries. Delaware's success should be replicated nationwide between public universities and private or nonprofit utilities. Another public-private partnership we've identified is the use of loan guarantees. The initial high capital costs can be prohibitive for much of Oceania's vision, particularly fleet modernization, offshore wind energy, and home and business upgrades. Loan guarantees are offering federal or state government loans at a low rate, potentially at zero interest, can rapidly encourage investment. For example, the Investments for Manufacturing Progress and Clean Technology Act, the IMPACT Act, Senate Bill 1503, which was introduced by Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, would offer loans to manufacturers to build advanced energy technologies like batteries for electric cars and wind turbine components. Another public-private partnership we've identified is offering tax credits by states or federal agencies. Some tax credits already exist for clean energy technology manufacturers and advanced fuels and for advanced vehicles. Wind energy relies on a production tax credit that reduces a company's tax base to aid in the profitability of wind power. Tax credits could also be extended to modernizing any petroleum-based residential, commercial, or industrial system, like HVAC systems, water heaters, or backup generators, to electric systems. Some concrete initiatives would be to increase and make permanent some of the clean energy tax credits outlined in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. For instance, the 30% credit for investment in clean energy technology manufacturing needs to be extended past its current 2012 deadline. Another initiative is Senate Bill S-3062, which was introduced by Senator Carper of Delaware. This bill would provide a production tax credit for offshore wind farms for the next decade. Other mechanisms to achieve Oceana Vision 2020 and 2035 include reinstating the offshore oil drilling moratorium that has protected American coasts for decades. Also, some $36 billion over the next decade is expected to subsidize oil and natural gas companies, and these subsidies should be cut. Additionally, we need to utilize policy mechanisms that increase the long-term demand for and supply of renewable energies, such as a robust renewable electricity standard. Next slide.
I just wanted to let you know we are at the 20-minute mark.
Thanks. By implementing Oceana Vision 2020 over the given timeframes, it is expected that some 6.9 billion barrels of oil will be conserved or offset. Achieving Oceana Vision 2035 would eliminate the need for offshore oil drilling as well as eliminate oil imports, making the United States truly energy independent. Oceana Vision 2035 would cost a total of $4.2 trillion over 25 years. But the avoided cost of oil purchases equals approximately $4.6 trillion, resulting in a total cost savings of $374 billion over 25 years. Next slide. When we achieve our vision, we will eliminate oil imports and offshore oil production, save consumers money, create more jobs, stave off climate change and ocean acidification, and promote renewable energy. Such a huge reduction in oil consumption will be particularly beneficial for the environment. Oceana's reliance on increasing renewable energy supply from offshore wind energy and biofuels further underscore the sustainability of this vision, as opposed to increasing fossil fuel supply from other sources, like coal or natural gas. Public and private investments, such as utilities and universities working together, loan guarantees, and tax credits, will be instrumental in achieving these goals. Next slide. It has been said that vision without action is a dream. Action without vision is simply passing the time, and action with vision is making a positive difference. Oceana's vision for a clean energy future will drastically reduce national oil consumption first by 2020 and then by 2035. By reducing oil consumption by improving shipping efficiency, eliminating oil-based electricity generation, modernizing home and commercial heating, and improving light-duty vehicles, Oceana's vision will provide a holistic approach to eliminate offshore oil drilling and imports from the Persian Gulf, with the vision to ultimately eliminate the need to import any oil. A plethora of sources, including offshore wind-generated electricity, biofuels, and electric vehicles, will pave the way to an oil-independent future for the United States. Last slide. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. We will now be opening up for questions. And the first question is, what impact would a Category 5 hurricane have on an offshore wind farm, say, off the coast of Florida?
Current wind turbines, onshore wind turbines, are actually capable of withstanding tornadoes, I'm originally from Missouri, and out in Kansas and in Missouri and Oklahoma, we have a lot of tornadoes. As you may know, tornado winds can actually be a lot stronger than hurricanes. And most offshore wind turbines in Europe are actually designed to withstand up to Category 4 hurricane force winds. Technologies do exist with these offshore wind turbines to feather the blades so they don't continually spin in excess wind speeds to help minimize the damage to the turbines.
The next question is, the University of Georgia, Georgia Tech, and your chart all indicate that Georgia has great potential for offshore wind. Is it likely that offshore wind might happen in Georgia? I'm discouraged by how little the state invests in renewable energy.
Well, I hope so. Here at Oceana, we think offshore wind energy is a really great renewable resource. And, you know, if it's economically and environmentally suitable, we need to be able to build it.
The next question. Intermittency is a regular issue raised by folks worried about over-reliance on solar and wind resources. How do you address this issue?
There's been plenty of studies done that show that if you build enough renewable energy, it actually provides its own backup. And this is where we get into a situation where you have a lot of renewable energy on the grid, and you need to modernize the grid at the same time. Denmark, for instance, has about 20% of its electricity coming from wind power at any given time. The way it works is throughout that entire country, they have models based on where the wind is going to be in a certain time frame, and they can actually ramp up other energy resources like biomass in that country to offset, you know, any sudden dips in wind power. And it's quite amazing. The National Renewable Energy Lab has actually just completed a study for the western portion of the United States, and they assumed that some 30% of the electricity came from solar power and wind energy, mostly from wind energy. And they actually showed that at that penetration rate, you didn't need to upgrade the grid all that much. So my concern in the short term is that let's get there. Let's get to the 30%. And then once we reach that, we, of course, you know, we need to modernize our grid system. Furthermore, with Oceana Vision 2020, further on down the line, as more vehicles become based on hydrogen or on battery-based electric vehicles, those vehicles can actually act as storage devices for the variableness of renewable energy. So at night, whenever you go home and you plug in your electric car and you're not using much energy, but the winds are blowing very strong, your car can actually charge overnight. And then whenever you go to work in the day, if there's excess need for electricity that the wind power or solar power or geothermal, whatever renewable energy, if that can't supply it, then the utility companies can actually siphon off a little bit of the energy from your battery. They won't go all the way to zero, so you can't drive home. But that's a much further on down the road. That's something that needs to be taken into consideration, but not right now.
Next question. Your largest oil savings of 2.5 MBD is in biofuels, with algae as the largest feedstock. Yet most experts believe that algae is still in the early research stages with no clear pathway to cost-effective commercialization. Do you have any independent validation of ability to commercialize algae-based ethanol in 10 years?
The biofuel portions of our plan does not specify exactly where we're going to get our biofuels. We want to make sure that our biofuels are non-food-based feedstock, so we don't want people burning corn in their cars. That being said, algae is a possibility, and we can use algae in the future. Like I said in my presentation, the Department of Energy just last week created the roadmap on how to commercialize algal biofuels. So, yes, it is a fairly new technology, but they are investigating it, and they're investigating it with money. They donated about $24 million in grants to investigate the commercialization of algal biofuels. Again, we're not saying that algal biofuels are the only way to go. We can use switchgrass. We can use crop residue. We can use fats and oils that are available in our kitchens and in our restaurants that's available. And so, again, Oceana's plan isn't saying algal is the only way that we need to go. It's definitely going to be a mix.
Next question. Why does your plan not include any solar energy production or use?
At Oceana, we are trying to fill a niche of what types of renewable energy haven't really gotten much attention. You know, solar energy is great, and we definitely think that it needs to be a part of our solution. But we've recognized that, as I said, you know, Europe has had offshore wind energy for the past 20 years. Why haven't we built offshore wind farms here in the United States? We have solar power plants. We have onshore wind farms, but we don't have offshore wind. And offshore wind represents a huge, cost-effective, low-cost opportunity for renewable energy. So that's why we focus on offshore wind.
Next question. Other than independence on PHEV batteries, what storage mechanisms have you considered?
At the early stages of our plan, we haven't looked into what we need to do in order to store the energy. Like I said answering a previous question, we can get up to about 30% of our renewable electricity without having to store our energy. And that's from the Department of Energy only using solar and wind power. So it's not even taking into consideration biomass. It's not taking into consideration geothermal. But there are other ways that we can store energy, and when those become commercialized, Oceana will promote those and will be looking forward to them. But as you well know, we can store hydrogen, we can store electricity and batteries in our vehicles. There was a presentation a couple days ago about compressed air in underground reservoirs. These are all possibilities.
Okay, the next question. Talk about your views on capacity and integrity of the grid. Some have called it antiquated.
It is. The United States is a really big country, and when we started putting together our electricity generation, it started basically in New York and was built out after that. The whole system wasn't designed as a system. It was built in bits and pieces. And because of that, it's very difficult to get lots of electricity from the middle of the country to the coast. About 78% of the energy consumed, or electricity consumed, I should say, actually happens in coastal states, whereas a lot of the renewable energy potential is in the middle of the country. And so in order to tap that effectively and send that renewable energy from the middle of the country to the coast, we're really going to have to ramp up additional transmission supply. That being said, offshore wind energy is a great opportunity because it is near the demand load, so we don't need nearly as many transmission lines to get it.
Next question. What role do you see energy efficiency playing in your plan? What is your recommended approach?
Oceana's plan actually incorporates energy efficiency. For example, with the shipping industry, one of the things that we've researched and found is that the industry, if they slow down by 10%, they can actually increase fuel efficiency by up to 25%. So that's a very simple way to incorporate energy efficiency. Additionally, moving to electric-based vehicles, electricity is actually a much better fuel to use in transportation. It's a lot more efficient than with oil consumption. But of course, there are things that people can do every single day that makes themselves more energy efficient. You know, turn off your lights when you're not in a room, shut off your water when you're brushing your teeth, that sort of thing. And those things need to be done. However, on the large scale systematic change that we need, Oceana works on federal legislation and in local areas to try and make this whole scale change. So it's very important that we all do our own part, but we also need to take this look at the system as a whole.
Thank you. Next question. So if you won the Clean Energy Gulf Challenge, how would you proceed to make your vision a reality?
Oceana, right now we're in the midst of finishing up a report on offshore wind energy and identifying ways that we can make offshore wind energy a reality in this country. Some things we've identified is the lack of offshore wind turbine manufacturers here in the United States. By publishing this report and using it up on Capitol Hill to go lobby officials to get the exact same things that I was talking about in my presentation, you know, make sure that we can have these loan guarantees, that we can have these tax credits available, so we can actually launch this clean energy revolution.
The next question, thank you. Oceana light-duty vehicle strategy includes EVs, yet Honda and Toyota have backed off the lithium-ion battery used in the Chevy Volt because lithium-ion is subject to explosions at high temperatures. How can you include EVs, given the massive commercialization of EVs has not been validated in terms of technology or cost?
If you'll notice in our plan doesn't rely excessively on electric vehicles. We rely mostly on diesel vehicles, which is like the Jetta TDI, and then hybrid electric vehicles like the Toyota Prius or the Honda Civic, so those kind of vehicles. Now, that being said, the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt are realities. They're coming into the market next year. If they don't use lithium-ion batteries, but they still use some other form of battery, we still get the expected increase in fuel efficiency from them. And additionally, those vehicles, they're expecting to sell, 50,000 or 100,000 just next year. So while we're at the very cusp of this technology, I think there is some room for improvement. And, if this technology fails, which I certainly hope it doesn't, we do have in the works hydrogen fuel cell technology, which I think is a little bit further behind in terms of massive commercialization as opposed to these electric vehicles.
Next question. We in Florida have little regional access to reliable wind source. Solar hot water and solar PV have been targeted by area renewable energy promoters. If solar is to be in the mix, what share of energy have you considered as a potential to join your plan?
Again, Oceana's plan is not to say that we shouldn't do solar, that offshore wind is the only way. And the question goes right to the heart of the matter that in Florida, there's a great solar resource. We haven't divvied up Florida specifically, but just to say, Florida does have an okay offshore wind energy resource as well. How much solar can you get? It's a matter of how much you want to pay. If you want to get 100% solar, theoretically, you could do it, but it is going to be more expensive than doing a mix. Like I said, we like to focus on offshore wind energy because it is something new that very few people have actually looked into. So I haven't actually looked into what percentage of energy Florida could get from solar, but I would imagine it's pretty significant.
Thank you. Next question. Offshore wind energy in Europe, specifically in Germany and Scandinavia, is expensive. What is the projected cost per kilowatt hour for offshore wind on the east coast of the United States?
Germany just installed their first offshore wind energy. If you really want to look at the cost of offshore wind energy, you really need to look at the United Kingdom. They have an economic and political system a lot more like the United States, and they're the number one energy producer from offshore wind energy. They're the biggest country that has offshore wind farms. With the UK, they're expecting their offshore wind energy to be in the price range of about 10 to 15 cents per kilowatt hour. The Department of Energy here in the United States has actually identified a huge amount of offshore wind energy resource potential for under 13 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, in Florida, the average cost for the residential electricity is about 12.5 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's slightly more expensive, but at the same time, you're not burning fossil fuels. You're not drilling for it. Additionally, even though there is a good track record with offshore wind energy being around for the past 20 years, there's a lot of new technological breakthroughs that are happening right now. One of them, for instance, is the use of direct drive turbine technology. Instead of using expensive gears to ramp up the RPMs into a generator from your turbine blades, manufacturers are starting to build larger scale permanent magnet generators. And by doing that, it's lowering the maintenance cost and it's actually producing more energy. So by using this technology and furthering research and development of it, we can expect the prices to go down pretty quick.
Great. Thank you. This is going to be the final call for questions. If you have any questions, please submit them now. Next question. What state policy developments that would support your plan are needed or should be considered as models for laggard states to consider?
Specifically dealing with offshore wind energy, I think New Jersey is fantastic. The state has called for some 1,000 megawatts of offshore wind farms to be built. They did a tendering process and received three winning bids to achieve basically 1,000 megawatts. So that's one process that you can do. Like I said in my presentation, Delaware is a really great state to watch. They have one or two farms proposed, offshore wind farms proposed. The University of Delaware has linked up with the utility company to push forward this electric cars acting as a baseload energy resource idea. And so there's quite a few of different potentials that different states are doing. And Maine, for instance, is just recently won a grant proposal to do research on deep offshore wind resource assessment and technology development. So all the states on the East Coast here are kind of doing their own little thing, but if you put it together and if you were able to put it together into a single state portfolio, I think it would be phenomenal.
Thank you. Next question. You said that improving shipping efficiency is the lowest hanging fruit for reducing our consumption. What work is being done with shipping companies to get them to reduce their consumption and increase their efficiency? Additionally, how effective has this strategy been?
Oceana has been researching this issue for 2 or 3 years now, and we've been trying to find ways that these shipping companies are already employing. There's a international United Nations body called the International Maritime Organization, where a lot of the shipping companies and countries come together and discuss sustainable shipping practices. And Oceana has been a part of some of those meetings to go talk about these benefits. Fortunately, since things like slowing down don't require any retrofits and it can actually save the company's money, it's pretty nice to be able to go to these companies and say, hey, you know, if you slow down a little bit, you can save a lot of fuel and actually save money. So it's pretty good. But in the future, with newer hull technologies and with basically giant sails on these ships, you can increase fuel efficiency fairly rapidly. It just costs a little bit more.
Simon, in that same vein, given that slowing ships down would increase the operating costs due to additional days at sea, why are you confident that this approach would be accepted by shipping, cargo, and cruise industry companies?
Well, if your fuel cost is a significant portion of your operating and maintenance, suggesting it is pretty much all you need to do. And we're basing our research off of what some companies have already been doing. So it's not as if we're saying, oh, let's do research and let's evaluate what they could do. These are real companies with real ships, and they are actually slowing down and saving fuel because of it. And that's why I'm so confident about it.
Final question. With widely expanded wind turbine resources, what impact on avian wildlife should be anticipated? How can we avoid or mitigate mortality?
Let me start off at the 100,000 foot level. Climate change is the biggest threat to avian life ever. If climate change is not curtailed, more birds will die than if you coat the planet with wind turbines. That being said, wind turbines are not without impact. some things that can be done to reduce avian mortality with wind turbines have already been put in place. Whenever wind turbines were first built in California many decades ago, the monopile was essentially a lattice work technology. It looks like a cell phone tower, which actually provided a great area for birds to perch on and hunt from, which also increased bird mortality. So doing things like turning the monopile in from a lattice work into a single solid steel tube has actually reduced avian mortality. Other things that need to be done is studies need to be completed to figure out exactly where the birds are going and if they are mitigating or steering around these wind turbines. Research done over in Europe on offshore wind turbines show that most birds actually avoid the wind turbines. They fly around them as opposed to flying right through the farms. And so that's good research that needs to be continued.
Thank you very much. I believe that is all the questions we have for today. Thank you so much, Simon, for your presentation, and we appreciate the audience's thoughtful questions. You can find out more about the Clean Energy Gulf Challenge finalists, including today's complete presentation and voting instructions, at www.cleanenergy.org. Public voting will open tomorrow, July 9th, and end at noon on Tuesday, July 13th. On behalf of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you.